Sounds True presents How to Meditate, Session 5, with Pema Chodron.
So this is going to be our final class. And so it's a little bit of a review and also fresh take at the same time. So we've been working with meditation, and in the first class we covered stabilization. I covered it, I mean that's a little... in other words, I referred to it and stressed its importance, and when we practiced together that was the intention when you were practicing, was to stabilize. And in the second class I emphasized that along with always coming back, and training in being present, and the profundity of that, to do that with gentleness, with kindness, with compassionate attitude, even humor, bring warmth into your practice, and how important this is. These points that I'm making, I've tried to hone it down to really what I feel from my own experience and listening to many, many people over the years are the sort of the essential points. So precision, or always coming back, faithful to the technique of returning to the present. And the present in meditation, in shamatha meditation, there's an object that you return to, such as the breath is the one we usually use. Returning to the breath. However, you can return to sounds and smells and sights, and we'll be working with that this morning. You can return to the present moment. That's the idea. But shamatha practice gives you an object, which makes it easier. So these two points, stabilization, or however you want to phrase that, always coming back, and warmth. In the third week, my intention was to emphasize that we come back to the present moment, which is to say we return to an open, fresh experience. Now, the potential is always here in any moment that when we come back, we're coming back to resting our mind in its natural state. And as beginning meditators, we have a lot more experience with being distracted and being caught up than we do with coming back, or resting our mind in its natural state, or being fully present, and the wonderfulness of that. Being fully present is really a way of talking about experiencing timelessness, experiencing what's sometimes called nowness, or sometimes it's called presence, but it means fully here, and this is an extremely profound thing. So in the third week, I was emphasizing the delight of what we come back to, the open space. And we did a meditation which was difficult for some of you, but which is an interesting one and which I encourage you to keep trying over the years. And this is that you begin with an attitude of attention, or just waiting for something to occur. In other words, waiting for a thought to occur. And then when it does, you follow the regular instruction. You acknowledge it as a thought with the label thinking, which I'm going to talk more about this morning, but that's like giving it your friendly attention for just a little while, like a moment, but you don't just kick it in the head. The warmth really comes in there when you realize you've been thinking, even if you've been thinking for 45 minutes, completely gone. At some point your mind does come back. And at that point, you say, it's so important, because you cannot connect with the open, natural state if you kick it in the head. There has to be warmth and spaciousness in your attitude of how you label thinking, you see? And if you acknowledge that thought really as like a cloud in the sky, like it's no big threat, currently you are addicted to it, but it's fundamentally no big threat. And so that has to be the attitude, some sense of light touch. So Trungpa Rinpoche used to talk about touching the thoughts and letting them go. So that touch is a subtle thing, because for us, touch usually means then we follow the momentum of the thought. It's hard for us to touch and not follow the momentum. But we're training in what I call experiencing just briefly the quality of that thought, or some sense of touching it, knowing it, and then returning to the breath. And sometimes that's all like one movement. So this practice of sitting and waiting for a thought to occur is a very interesting one, because it pre-assumes something which we aren't all able to do, which is that there's some access to just attention, pure awareness, nothing happening, big sky mind, and then the cloud comes in. It's usually very hard to catch the moment of it entering. But then we realize, and we just, from this perspective, you could begin to get the hang of then the thoughts could actually dissolve back into the big sky mind. And at some point, our practice leads us to the point of seeing the inseparability of thoughts and space, like thoughts are not a problem, except that we follow after the momentum of the thoughts, and this keeps us caught in recycling same old thoughts, the same old patterns that we're very, very identified with, and it increases our suffering. So we're really working with this light touch, letting go, so that we interrupt the momentum of the thoughts. But we should understand from the beginning that thoughts themselves are not the problem. Thank goodness, because there's always going to be thoughts. And if we thought we had to get rid of them once and for all, we'd probably have a nervous breakdown long before we had enlightenment, you know. And the sense of discouragement would be so strong. But interrupting the momentum, this is something that we can all do. But we have to train in it, we have to practice in it. But definitely, this is extremely workable, to interrupt the momentum of the thoughts. But the third class was about that sense of that there is space available in every moment of our lives, and that we could connect with it. The fourth class was about including our emotional distress in our meditation, that when what we call kleshas, or strong emotions, arise when we're sitting or in our life altogether, that's part of our meditation. That's not considered an interruption to meditation, or something that we need to squelch, or something that we need to be ashamed of. It's considered the object of our meditation. And in that fourth class, I gave instruction on how to abide with the experience, and in this case, the experience of strong energy. And my hope here is that we could begin to do this when sitting and throughout our entire lives. So I think this is very interesting. I wanted to, at this point, just refer to two texts. The first is our song, The Seven Delights. And I think it would be good for you to study this over, not so much study it, but just read it over and over and actually learn to sing it, because it's a very, very profound view, but it is the view that we work with. We work with basic shamatha practice, but it has this Vajrayana view. So in the first line, I thought it was Milarepa, but it's Godsangpa. So in the first paragraph, he says, when thoughts that there is something perceived and a perceiver, so when thoughts of self and other, which is basically what all thoughts are about, right? I am thinking about that, me and it, you know, it's kind of hard to have a thought that isn't based on that. That'd be interesting. See if you can have a thought that doesn't have a perceived and a perceiver. Probably not. That would probably be not a thought. But he said, when those lure my mind away and distract. So usually you think meditation, oh my gosh, my mind has been lured away and distracted, you know. And then you kick the thought in the head. And you kick it in the head with the idea, I am that thought, I am bad to have done this, my meditation is a wreck. And there's a lot of history in this, a lot of conditioning can happen right there in that moment. But he says that he plunges straight into its essential point. He basically says he doesn't try to block it and meditate without the thoughts. He plunges right into the essential point, which is that these thoughts are like clouds in the sky. There is this shimmer when they fly. It's a beautiful line. They're like clouds in the sky. There's this shimmer where they fly. Thoughts that arise for me, sheer delight. So I love this because it presents a view that could bring such joy into your life. In the last verse, he says, you know, adverse conditions happen. When they do, it's so delightful. They make a little song of sheer delight. If you could remember this, as the next verse says, when the kleshas get me going and their heat has got me burning. So he knew what a klesha felt like. Then he doesn't say, do anything you can to, you know, like squelch it or anything. He says, like an alchemistic portion turning metal into gold, what lies in klesha's power to bestow is bliss without contagion, completely undefiled. Klesha's coming up, sheer delight. Well, this is a very profound teaching, and it's actually what we're doing here. We're training in being present, and we're saying, in the fourth class, the intention was present to whatever arises, including this strong, what we call, adverse conditions. And so we're training now in just simple shamatha, but our view is very vast. Our view is that these things which we think are wrecking our lives, like our thoughts and our emotions, and he also talks about illness and death, little things like that. And he says, when the whole thing's just not working, everything's lined up against you, don't try to find some way to change it all. And then he gives like this very important instruction. He says, here the point to make your practice is just to reverse the way you see it. Reverse the way you see it. So I'd like to leave you with this class with the idea that when you realize you're thinking, that could be sheer delight. You could just see it as a cloud in the sky and just say, no big deal. And with the attitude of sheer delight, you know, let it go. So to introduce this idea that nothing actually fundamentally is a problem except our identity with it. And we have a very strong identity with our thoughts and emotions. We can't kid ourselves about that. But if you think that we're training to wean ourselves from this little teeny narrow view about these things, which is that it's me and me with a problem, basically, or me with a little relief for once, you know, sort of attitude. And instead, we think that our practice is whatever arises to experience it directly, and then whether it's pleasant, a pleasant sound or an unpleasant sound, a pleasant smell or an unpleasant smell, a pleasant thought or an unpleasant thought, and so on and so forth, it's sheer delight because our attitude is that instead of identifying with it, in this case, at the level we're working now, we simply touch it with the label thinking and let it go. But you see, I'm giving you quite a profound view here of what we're actually doing with this practice. So the attitude, getting back to the second class of gentleness, is being taken a little further here, that it actually can even be an attitude of sheer delight. And in Kenzin Rinpoche's text, The Heart Treasure of the Enlightened Ones, there's a beautiful instruction in this, which is the same when he says, don't follow after the object of hatred. Look at the angry mind. Anger, liberated by itself as it arises, is mirror-like wisdom. And then don't chase after the object of pride. Look at the grasping mind. self-importance liberated by itself as it arises is the wisdom of equanimity. And don't hanker after the object of desire. Look at the craving mind. And he goes through all the kleshas this way, basically saying they're not a problem if you just will give them your attention. So what this means in the instruction that we follow, strangely enough, is, all right, klesha, strong emotion, arises, you say, I'm going to let the thoughts about it go and just reside in the experience, knowing that its essence is clear, unobstructed energy. Do you see what I'm saying? Maybe that's just a view you hold, because maybe you're not experiencing it as clear, unobstructed energy. And you don't have to talk yourself into anything. But usually what we do is we talk ourselves into big deal. This is a problem, I'm angry, I'm bad, I have to fix it. You know, like we go on for days about these kleshas. Our anger, our jealousy. I've got to solve this. Every interview I have is people telling me about their kleshas and they want to know what they should do. But they always want to know, should they change their job, leave their relationship, this is outside the Abbey, of course, or equivalents here with the monks and nuns. And the answer is, look right at the klesha itself. And nobody wants to do this. They always say, yes, but there's this problem. And really you say, okay, if you don't just right now decide to look at the angry mind with this attitude of pure delight, with this attitude of gentleness and warmth, with this attitude of abiding with the energy, you're going to have problems for the rest of your life, because basically you're just buying into problem every time as me and other. And so you never are going to unwind it. So sooner or later you've got to stop solving the outer problems and work with the cause of suffering. And if you do that, then you get very good at actually knowing what to say and what to do and what changes to make, because it comes out of a different space. And it's not just making the grooves deeper of our conditioned mind about our problems. So having said this, this is an introduction to this morning's practice, which is that we're going to work with the six sense perceptions as an object of meditation. And we may not do them all, but the six consciousnesses, hearing, so we're going to work with sounds as meditation, sight, so looking at sight as object of meditation, feeling, or you know, like touch, is a very interesting one, so we'll work with that one. And this is actually where breath comes in, and body all together. At this point, we'll also work with breath a little bit. And then tasting and smelling, which are not as accessible here in the shrine room, so if we're running out of time, we might not work with those two, but those are good ones to use any time that you eat or really have a sense of pleasant or unpleasant smell or taste. Just use it as an object of meditation. And then the sixth sense consciousness is thinking, the mind consciousness. And we'll work a little bit with that as well. So doing this morning is a way of bringing in the idea that you can use anything as an object of meditation. And if you do, anything that's happening to you, whether it's just a sound or a strong emotion, sheer delight. It can be sheer delight for you. Or it can be sheer misery. It's kind of your choice. You know, that's a terrible smell. We shouldn't use that kind of incense. Or, oh, they're burning the oatmeal. And, you know, I get this terrible indigestion when I eat that burned oatmeal. And then I don't feel well for days. And, you know, you're off on this thing and you're angry at the cook and blah, blah. And you're leaving the Abbey and you're packing your bags. And all it was a smell. So you begin to see that your life is very, very funny when you start to practice this way, because little things like sights, smells, sounds, thoughts, memories, little arisings of energy which turn into full-blown kleshas, they just run us around in circles and keep us living in a fantasy world, and basically we cause our own suffering because we never humorously, with a sense of sheer delight, interrupt the momentum of this whole process, this whole chain reaction of suffering. So today this is training in experiencing, direct experience. It's an exercise in realizing that we have this innate awareness, and that at any time, if we're willing, we can directly connect with the immediacy of our experience, that we all have this innate awareness, which is our gateway to limitless experience, the vastness of this world. But these very same sense perceptions can keep you locked in also if you keep rerunning the sense of my thought, my emotion, my smell, my aversion, my attraction, and so forth, the idea of identifying with these. So we interrupt the momentum of the thoughts and come back to the sound or the smell or the feeling or the thought or the emotion. If you can start to practice this way with every little thing throughout your day, then you'll find that when challenges arise, you can practice then as well, because you're used to interrupting the momentum of there's something wrong here that I have to solve, or I'm a failure, or whatever the familiar story is. You're used to interrupting the momentum of that and going right to the experience itself, which I have been calling the felt sense of the experience. But really, there's nothing, the more you're with it, the more you realize that it's an open doorway to emptiness, an open doorway to enlightenment, an open doorway to egolessness, to shunyata, to rigpa. These very same things that get you going, if you interrupt the momentum and just abide with the quality of the moment, it's a doorway for you into the full possibility of full awakening in this life. So we're just going to be working here with sense perceptions, but I wanted to make it clear the very profound view that we're working with here, what it is we're actually doing. So the text that I was referring to is by Pachul Rinpoche, and it's called The Heart Treasure of the Enlightened Ones, with a commentary by Dingo Kenzo Rinpoche. And so what we're doing here is, rather than always dividing ourselves in half, like there's a thought and then there's me observing the thought, or there's an emotion, and then so part of me is criticizing the other part of me as being bad, like there's this dualistic thing, or part of me is hearing a sound out there. It's no difference really whether it's me calling myself bad, that's still two, you know. So what we're doing when we just listen to a sound or just contact the quality of the moment of a thought or an emotion or what or a sound, whatever it is, when we just come into the immediacy of our experience, that's a non-dualistic experience. So we're saying, I'm a bad meditator. I can't do what Pema's asking me to do here. So then the instruction would be, see if you can feel what I can't do, what Pema's asking me to do here feels like right in that very moment. Just stop wherever you are in the storyline of praise or blame, failure or success, and just have a second of touching in. So what that might be is just, it might just be go to your body and feel how your physical reaction is. That might develop over time into a more complete quality, almost like the smell of it or the taste of it, you know, sort of a nonverbal thing. But anything you can do to have a direct experience, and I think for most people, the most accessible thing is to feel it physically. You can feel your stomach or your, you know, because it's sort of tight and uncomfortable, your shoulders or your head or your teeth clenching, whatever it might be. But then it leads you toward and you may have already had this experience, actually I'm sure we all have one time or another, is there's actually like a more of a quality of the moment. When you feel, as he says, that it's all stacked up against you and nothing's going right, if you just pause for a moment, that is a lot of physical felt. You feel it in your body, but there's also a kind of like a almost an atmosphere. And if you could just almost like try to hear it, smell it, taste it, you know, trying to use words. Rinpoche, Trungpa Rinpoche used to use words for this that were non-conceptual to try to get you to move closer to your experience in a non-dualistic way. So we're moving toward being able to experience our world without the strong ego identity, which is this dualistic thing. But what's actually quite confusing is that there's always awareness. But then you just let it be like that. I mean, enlightened people are aware. They do hear. They do smell. They do think. They do have emotions. But it's more of a non-dualistic experience of that. But for us, we just use our innate awareness to perceive as directly as we can, and that's good enough. That's all we're training and doing. And then that unfolds by itself. We don't try to have an experience we're not having. We don't try to live up to something we read in a text. We always just work with right now. And actually, right now is all we ever have. And if right now you're saying, I can't live up to it, then go right into that feeling right now. Because otherwise, you're just strengthening a belief that I'm not up for it, and the future will never come. You'll just always be in the present moment of, oh, I'm not up for it, and getting better and better at it. You see what I'm saying? So we're interrupting that momentum and touching the immediacy of the experience. And that's our view, and I think it'd be good to re-listen to this particular talk so that you remember this view when you come in here to sit, or when it gets tough, when life gets tough, which is usually happens almost every day.